Well, we've looked at consecrated chastity, which is about where we put our first love. And then we looked at obedience, which is our listening to the one who loves us and whom we love, with a view to wanting only what God wants, as best we can discern that, and commitment to try to discern it together. So now we move to consecrated poverty. When the Pope, in his letter introducing the, or homily introducing the year of consecrated life, he went on to speak about the expectations that he had for this year, and the fourth of them was that we would go to the margins. And one of his statements in that is, we find love by giving love. We find hope by giving hope. We find life by giving life. So let me share with you my best reflections for what they're worth on this vow that we've all shared. Poverty is not having what is necessary for a meaningful human existence. I hope that's a reasonable definition anyhow. Not having what is necessary for a meaningful human existence. This obviously includes food, clothing, housing, but most importantly, it includes love. However important economic factors are, we cannot limit poverty to economic poverty without limiting human need. A person who does not have love is very poor indeed, whatever his or her economic condition. The level of poverty will vary, obviously, from person to person. The more areas in which a person is deprived of real human needs, the more, obviously, that person is poor. Poverty, as I've just defined it, is unequivocally evil. It's not to be sought for oneself or for others. Everything should be done to alleviate and abolish it. I was hungry, said Jesus, and you gave me to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me to drink. From the prophet Amos, chapter 2. I will not revoke the punishment because they sell the righteous for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals. Scholars who look behind all this and look at the situation suggest that the pair of sandals are actually bought to make a pilgrimage to Jerusalem. It's highly likely anyhow. So they're doing something religious, they're doing something pious, they're doing something expected of them, they're doing something that's good, but they're doing it because they're robbing from the poor. They sell the righteous for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals. They who trample the head of the poor into the dust of the earth and push the afflicted out of their way. Father and son go into the same girl. Girl, it may be a sexual thing, it's probably not. It's to do with some asherah, some goddess that they're going to. So that my holy name is profaned. They lay themselves down beside every altar on garments taken in pledge, and in the house of their God they drink wine bought with fines that they imposed. So Amos is ripping into the rich, who are rich because they've made others poor. Poverty, as I've just defined it, has never been the object of the religious vow. When religious suffered poverty, There was always an attempt to remove it by begging, by working, by careful handling of resources. Detachment, simplicity of life, the common life, accountability are required of religious by their vow. But these virtues, detachment, simplicity of life, the common life, accountability, are exactly what they say. They're not poverty. What we vow as religious is to be poor like Jesus. That's our focus. Now, for the most part, Jesus was not poor as we've been describing it. No one was really, hardly, in the world of Jesus. It was a subsistence farming. They had what they needed. There was food around. They didn't have what we now know as poverty in some of these places. So generally speaking, they weren't poor in that sense. For the most part, Jesus was not poor. He had what is necessary for a meaningful human existence. He was poor in the sense that he shared in the human condition by being totally dependent on love. And so, on the free choices of others to give love or not give it. He was given a lot of love, you see that in the Gospels. He was deprived of a lot of love, which you also see there, as you are and I am, in our real world. That's part of the human condition. Jesus was poor in that he shared the human condition of having to undergo experiences which he could integrate and in which he could remain sinless only with a struggle. He had to integrate into his life the fleeing of the disciples from the garden, the betrayal of Peter by Peter, crowd saying, crucify him, that he'd cared for. He had to integrate all that. And it was a struggle, but he did it. He never reacted except in love. Jesus was poor, and this is our vow, in that he lived in intimate communion with his Father, who is Yahweh, the one who hears the cry of the poor. Jesus chose, therefore, to be with people insofar as they were poor, crying out to God in their distress. That's what the Bible all the way through, as best I'm able to understand it. Poor means, yes, deprived of what we need, but to be the anawim, the poor, it also requires that they cry out to God in their poverty. That's part of the essence of the spiritual reality of being poor. Blessed are the poor. So Jesus chose to be with people insofar as they cried out to God in their distress, and he took up their cause. He was willing to be counted among them and to take the consequences of this. Is that what we vow? Jesus was faithful to his commitment to the poor, even when it meant that he was excommunicated, ostracized, stripped of human dignity, human power and reputation, and disturbed by fear, racked by pain. He faced an apparently meaningless death, even experiencing being abandoned by his Father. To be poor like Jesus is to accept, and that's a matter of belief, and live out, which is a matter of lifestyle, my total dependence on love, the love that is God. This is possible only to the extent that I'm obedient like Jesus, meaning hearing in every person and in every event of my life, God as Abba saying to me, to you, you're my son, I love you, in you my heart delights. Welcoming that, believing it, holding on to it and acting from it is at the heart of our vow of poverty, our vow of recognizing our total need on love. But the love is there for us, and trusting that, we live our life. Listening to this and believing the one who speaks to me, I learn, like Jesus, to love like Jesus, to enter into a covenant of love with the world and to be faithful to that covenant. What does this mean? It means being willing to give myself to any person insofar as that person is deprived of anything he or she needs to live a dignified human existence. So we stand beside such a person, do our best to love them. Secondly, it means it's a matter of sympathy, which comes straight from the Greek. Feeling with, compassion, comes straight from the Latin, same meaning. So it's a matter of sympathy, compassion, being with, feeling with, offering oneself to poor persons, needy persons, everyone in fact, while accepting their offering of themselves to us. And maybe what we can offer to someone who is poor is crying out to God in trust, so that they'll be truly the poor of the scriptures. Thirdly, it's a matter of doing what we can, accepting inability with them, continuing to affirm that death is not the end. Our horizon, like that of Jesus, goes beyond death. For we do believe in the justice of God. We do what must be done now, while hoping for what only God can give beyond the realm of human injustice and sin. Fourthly, we must pray for the grace that the many advantages we have received will not put a barrier between us and those who have not received these advantages. Advantages of a position in society as a priest, advantages of education, you can add on to that. If we venture to call ourselves poor, which we do when we say we take a vow of poverty, if we venture to call ourselves poor because of this, we must do humbly, and we must do it in front of those to whom the name belongs, hoping to be embraced by a God who's already theirs, not by reason of their being better or worse, but because it's God's choice to be their saviour. Isn't our present Pope telling us all the time, we've got so much to learn from the poor. Religious who commit themselves to be with any person insofar as that person lacks what is necessary for a meaningful human existence, who hear the cry of the poor and take up the cause of the poor, who are closer in heart, in lifestyle and in sympathy to those who are poor than to those who are, inverted commas, rich, can call themselves poor only, I suggest, when four conditions are fulfilled. So if I'm going to call myself poor, I think I need to look at these four conditions for it. Otherwise our vow of poverty is kind of meaningless and doesn't communicate anything to anyone. They don't know what we mean. And maybe we don't know what we mean. So let's look at these conditions, and you make up your own mind about them, of course. Condition one. Excuse me. To call ourselves poor, we must do all our thinking about poverty in the presence of those who, according to the indices of need, are recognized as being truly poor. To them, the word more properly belongs. They will know if our lives speak of good news to them or not. They will know if we're playing blind man's bluff, playing at being blind while able to go away and see, playing at being poor while having available all the resources to meet our needs. They'll know it. So we're in a very subtle area here. To say, I have a vow of poverty, sitting with someone who's really, really, really poor, to fail to recognize this is it to be proud of heart? The ones to whom Jesus addressed the words, woe upon you who are rich, who have all you need, think you have all you need, and don't recognize your dependence on God. Don't cry out to God in your need. That are the rich. And the danger, of course, in our society is that when wealth is so significant to people, I only had a phone call last night which was totally distressing from a beautiful woman who's, anyway, I don't want to go on too much about it, but caring for her parents. And she's as poor as poor as poor as poor as poor. And she has rich, rich, rich sisters who are doing nothing at all for their parents. And that's what's hurting her. So, richness, whatever the word is, wealth, has got in between people and the simple things of caring for parents even. Some acknowledge and accept their dependence and live it out. It's to these that Jesus spoke when he said, oh, blessed are the poor in spirit. And that's what we pray to be, in fact, vow to be. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Apart from the cry of the poor, all prayer, including the liturgy of the church, can become a dangerous drug, because God, the Father of Jesus, is the one who hears the cry of the poor. And we may be going through all our rituals and not crying out to God in our need. They may be substituting for real, genuine religion. This is Pope Paul VI at Bogota in 1968, speaking to the poor. You are a sign, you are an image, you are a mystery of the presence of Christ. The sacrament of the Eucharist offers us his hidden presence. But you too are a sacrament, he said, a sacred image of the Lord among us, as it were a revealing, unconcealed reflection of his human and divine countenance. All the Church's tradition recognizes in the poor the sacrament of Christ, a mystical correspondence with the Eucharist. What a lovely Plymouth statement. Paul VI, I got a feeling he's the greatest of them all. We've had some very good popes. for a long time. But he really stands out, I think. He was so intelligent and so... And John the 23rd opened the windows, opened the doors, and then died. Somebody had to kind of cope with what was going on, and that was Paul the 6th. The breakdown of marriage, the breakdown of religious life, people leaving because they couldn't cope with the new church, and people fighting against it, and, well, you know, all that happened. And this dear man, they broke him eventually, poor man. I think they broke him. If anyone was going to refresh, reform the Vatican, it was going to be this man, because he knew it. He was right at the heart of it. And he was intelligent and careful and loving and whatever, feeling kind of a... And he couldn't do it. Couldn't do it. It finally just overwhelmed him. Our present Pope is giving him his best shot to... If he doesn't get shot in Africa, I hope he has a good go at doing it. Anyhow, I'm sorry. But he's saying here to the poor people of this of Bogota, you are a sacrament. At Puebla, 1979, he said, when we draw near the poor in order to accompany them and serve them, we're doing what Christ taught us to do when he became our brother, poor like us. Hence, service of the poor is the privileged, though not the exclusive, gauge of our following of Christ. When we do reflect on poverty in the presence of the poor, we mustn't fail to notice that despite its awful capacity to destroy, poverty does have a special power to open people to the truth and so to God. I don't want to romanticize poverty, of course, and in fact I don't know much about it, which is probably becoming obvious to you. I'm trying to understand it, but in our culture it's... But sometimes when I look at countries where the people, most of them, are really poor, they look so much happier than the people in my parishes or your parishes. Or there's something happened, but probably they just need each other and they just care for them. And again, I don't want to romanticize it, but I think, wow, when you go into our cities with people protecting themselves against their neighbours, I know that's not completely fair, but isolated. I don't know how some of you people, in fact, come from other cultures. And as a priest, I go and work in a parish, and you walk out into the street and there's no one. The little time I spent in India, 8 months or something, as novice master there, filling up a year because someone needed a break. God help us, you walked outside the front door and there's a million people staring at you and walking past you, and that's a different feeling. And I didn't know what to do. You kind of feel a bit... Well, people from there coming here and walking into the street, there's not a soul to be seen. You've got to knock on the door. And, I don't know. How you do it, God bless you. I guess the point I'm trying to make is simple. When we do this, poverty does have, it would seem, a special power to open people to their obvious need and to the truth and so to God. It can bring home a person's existential need of God. It can impel a person to cry out to God in his or her distress. It can bring a person to listen to God and trust in God's word. None of that's automatic, but it can do that because they're clearly in need. What about us in our culture where people are setting out to avoid being in any need? So there's the first condition, I think. If I'm going to say I have a vow of poverty, I've got to say it in front of the poor in a way that they can recognize. Second condition, to call ourselves poor, we must do all our thinking in the presence of Christ crucified, looking upon the one we've pierced. He gave his life because his heart was one with that of his Father. He bore witness to God's compassion for all, especially for those who had no reason to be convinced of this truth except their experience of Jesus. He met people who were poor and in despair, blind, lame — they're all symbolic things, of course. Blind, can't see, lame, don't know where to go, leper, ostracized. I'm not saying they aren't real things, but that's why they're in the gospel, because they're about people. And he kept loving them into life. If we're going to call ourselves poor, that needs to be part of it. Giving hope to people who don't have hope, being a father to those who don't have father, being a lover, inverted commas, to those who have no love. Condition 3. To call ourselves poor, we must do all our thinking about poverty while embracing the world. We must believe in the world and recognize our responsibility for its desecration. The encyclical makes that point so simply and so convincingly. We've got to embrace this world. I have to learn to embrace the world in which I am. And that's not easy. But anyhow, we have to embrace the people that are there with us. And finally, another condition, I think. To call ourselves poor, we must do all our thinking in a heart, our heart that's consecrated to God. Blessed are the pure in heart, they shall see God. They shall hear God's response to the cry of the poor. Whatever threatens to possess our hearts that is not of God, and that would distance us from the poor, must be shunned. Jesus, unless you change and become like a little child — doesn't mean be childish, it means be like a little child who's totally confident in a parent's love, but obviously totally in need of it — unless you change and become like a little child, you'll never enter the kingdom of heaven, said Jesus. So let's look at some of the things that could stop me from being truly poor. Material riches, obviously. Zacchaeus might be an example of that. The rich young man certainly is. Worries. Martha is an example of that. Lovely that she's doing all the cooking, and that's lovely. But Jesus says, Martha, you're worried, you're distracted. Because instead of just cooking and enjoying it, she's thinking, why isn't Mary here helping me? Pride might be the problem. Unrepentance. Preconceptions. Nazareth, you know, they said, isn't this Jesus? What do we know? His brothers and sisters, and he's — where does he get all this wisdom? So they wouldn't accept him because he was too normal. They wanted someone, wow, to wow them. And they've got this gentle, loving, beautiful man not doing any magic for them. Power and prestige, Pharisees, is that stopping them? Power. High priest, what was his problem? Why didn't he saw what Mary of Magdala saw? Pilate, you know, like all the gospel stories, Herod, with these people who can't hear and can't listen. That could be me. Any element of there will be stopping me see Jesus and be poor with him. Jesus said, if you exalt yourself, you'll be humbled. If you humble yourself, you'll be exalted. I can be poor without purity of heart, but I cannot be a sign of hope to the poor without it. I may give all I have, says Paul, but if I lack love, self-giving, I'm nothing. You're checking all this for yourself, of course, because I'm not sure it's right. It's just that I have reflections on it. The problem of poverty is personal and therefore institutional. It involves the way people relate. A person is a relating individual, not just an individual. It involves the way people relate economically and in every way. It therefore demands a communal commitment to oppose institutionalized selfishness, exploitation, and irresponsibility. It involves contributing to every effort to alleviate poverty by creating structures, including economic ones, which will effectively relate finite resources to human ends by cooperation, criticism, or condemnation. If we're able to play a role in effectively responding to the cry of the poor, we'll need to be involved in communal processes. Politics, economics, law, etc. If we live by the truth and in love, says Paul, we will grow in all ways into Christ. So we're going to need, we as a Scalabrinians, as missionaries of the Sacred Heart, as whatever, Catholics, we're going to need new common experiences to give us new insight. We're going to need new common, shared understandings of these experiences. We're going to need processes for common reflection to bring us to a new common affirmation in regard to how things really are and the desirability of really being poor like Jesus as a body. We're going to need consensus concerning what ought to be done and to realize this value that we've discerned, and we're going to need common decisions to do what is to be done. That's just a process of logical process. We've got to have the experiences first. We've got to try and come to understandings that we can share. We've got to think of what things are really like and what we need to do. Then we need a consensus, and then we need decisions to do as a body of missionaries of the Sacred Heart or of Scalabrinians. I find this haunting. I don't quite know what to make of it, but I find it haunting. You might too. Abbé Pierre, you probably know. Abbé, he was a priest after the Second World War. France has destroyed much of it, and he was looking after people of the street and trying to get work for the poor, etc. And he founded a community, and this is what he said. Let us never lose our living conviction that it is not necessary to wait till we're splendid people before we can do splendid things. That would probably mean waiting a long time, in fact too long. We need only to understand one splendid thing and then try to base our whole life upon it. And that thing is that the person we must help in all things is the person who is suffering the most. Without knowing what to do about it, I sense he's got a real insight there. The person we must help in all things is the person who is suffering the most. A thought that has occurred to me, all this business in Paris, which you know all about, I wonder if the person who's suffering the most could be the mother of those boys that have been radicalized. I don't know. Could be. What a tragedy it would be if she was slammed along with them and along with the Muslim community. She might be the one suffering the most and needing the most love and care. Imagine being a mother and having your children radicalized by some mufti or whatever and suiciding, blowing themselves up and killing all these people. Here's Abbé Pierre telling me, reminding me, look, find out who's suffering the most and that's where your focus starts. This is Albert Nolan, whom you've probably read, Option for the Poor. He wrote this. The options, he worked in South Africa, or still does, I think. The option for the poor is an uncompromising and unequivocal taking of sides in a situation of structural conflict. It's not a matter of preaching to some people rather than others. It's not a matter of being generous to the underprivileged, or a judgment about the personal guilt of the rich, or even, in the first instance, a matter of lifestyle. Option for the poor is the assertion that Christian faith entails for everyone, and as a part of its essence, the taking of sides in the structural conflict between the oppressor and the oppressed. I think that's really so wise and so good. Continuing. A thoroughgoing option for the poor, says Albert Nolan, includes the willingness to question one's assumptions, to learn from those who are oppressed. It's only after one has learned to have a confidence in the ability of the oppressed to promote their own cause and to bring about their own liberation that one can begin to share that struggle with them and to make a contribution in real solidarity with all those who've taken an option against oppression. I'm waiting for the day when it's easy to blame bishops, and I'm not blaming them, but somehow or other we've got to. I'd love to think that the bishops' conference urged every parish to go out in the streets and demonstrate against what's happening in Marnus Island and so on, Christmas Island. The dreadful stuff Australia is doing, I reckon if we did, we'd change it. So then I got to say to myself, well, why aren't you doing it? Why don't I start it? And then I don't know what to do. But we've got to do something to say that's not us and that's dreadful. Here's dear Sandra Snyders again. You'll be sick, you know you won't. But anyhow, here she is. She says this in her new wineskins. See if you think it might be right. I'm drawing to an end now. If the religious vow of poverty is going to make sense today, even to religious themselves, to say nothing of other people, it cannot continue to be understood as a private reality operating in the closed system that the religious subculture once constituted. It has to relate the religious enterprise to the enormous human project of organizing material resources for the creation of a genuinely human world. Religious poverty has to clearly cast the weight of Christianity into the balance on the side of responsible stewardship, institutional reform, and the liberation of the poor. If you think that's worth further reflection, it's on the website. She continues. Even more importantly, and I'll conclude with this, it should help to surface and make explicit the potentially evangelical values in this world's struggle for a human economy and contribute an evangelical dimension where none yet exists. Remember, she's writing in America. To build the evangelical dimension into the contemporary economic struggle means to contribute to the effort not only by cooperation, criticism, or condemnation, but by a mode of behavior which arises directly from a gospel poverty of spirit, itself the fruit of a profound experience of God's gift to us in Jesus. I'll conclude with the prayer you know so well. Join in if you want to. Prayer of Saint Francis. And these are the ducks on our little pond that you're about to see.
Master, grant.